All right, welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. We're diving into a pretty fascinating Fourth Amendment case today. It comes out of the First Circuit, United States v. Kuntsevan, and basically we're going to be looking at a search warrant, what makes a search warrant pass muster, and in particular, we're focusing on the role of confidential informants in getting these warrants. So how much evidence do police actually need, and is it controlled by enough?
Yeah, that's really the crux of the issue here. I mean, it gets right at this tension we always see between law enforcement needing to do their jobs and investigating crime, but also our constitutional rights, you know?
Totally. Balancing that government power with individual liberties. So this case kind of puts a spotlight on that very tension, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so to lay the groundwork, what were the circumstances that led to this guy, Thakon Kuntsevan's conviction? What happened in this case?
Well, he was convicted on federal drug charges because police found crack cocaine in his apartment. But the whole thing hinges on how they got that evidence. And that's where the search warrant comes in.
Right, right. So tell me a little bit about this warrant. What information did the police use to convince the judge to sign off on it?
Yeah, so the warrant application was largely based on information from a confidential informant. This informant had told a detective, Detective Rocha, that a couple of guys, Fat Boy and Turtle, were selling drugs out of a specific apartment. Even gave the address, 676-678 Chalkstone Avenue in Providence, Rhode Island. Described what apartment number it was, first floor rear, and even gave physical descriptions of the two guys.
Okay, so you've got this tip from an informant. But I'm guessing a tip alone isn't usually enough to get a warrant to search someone's home. You need more, right?
You're exactly right. You need something more to kind of back up that tip to give it some weight. And that's where the controlled by comes in.
Okay, so tell me about this controlled by. How did that play out in this case?
So the police, they set it up pretty carefully. They search the informant first, make sure they don't have any drugs or extra money on them. Then they give the informant a specific amount of cash and watch them go into the building at that address. A little while later, the informant comes back out and hands the cops crack cocaine, saying they bought it from Fat Boy.
Got it. So the police didn't actually see the drug deal go down inside the apartment, though, right?
Oh, that's an important point. They only saw the informant going in and coming out. They couldn't see what happened inside.
Okay, and so Kuntsevan is charged, convicted, but he appeals, right? What was his main argument against his conviction?
Yeah, he appealed. And his main argument was that the affidavit, you know, the sworn statement that the detective used to get the warrant, it just didn't have enough evidence to show probable cause. He's saying the judge shouldn't have signed the warrant in the first place.
Interesting. And this takes us to a big legal principle that comes up all the time in Fourth Amendment cases. The totality of the circumstances test. I know we've talked about it before, but can you remind our listeners what that actually means in a case like this? How does it apply here?
Sure. So the totality of the circumstances test, it comes from a Supreme Court case, Illinois v. Gates. And it's basically how judges decide if there's probable cause, especially when you're dealing with stuff like informant tips, which are considered hearsay, right? It's not like the police saw it themselves.
Right, right.
So instead of some strict checklist of things you have to have, the judge has to look at all the information together and use common sense to decide if it's fairly probable that they'll find evidence of a crime in that specific place.
Fairly probable. So it's not about being 100% certain. It's a lower standard than that.
Yeah, exactly. Probable cause doesn't mean you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, or even like more likely than not, it's a lower bar.
Right.
So in Kuntsevan, the big question was, did the informant's tip, along with that controlled by, was it enough to meet that fairly probable standard?
Okay, and you touched on this earlier, but I think it's worth repeating. Just having a controlled by, that doesn't automatically mean there's probable cause to search a specific home, right?
Right, exactly. Because a controlled by itself, it could mean different things. It shows someone is selling drugs somewhere, but it doesn't necessarily tie it to one specific place, like one apartment.
Right.
I mean, imagine the informant could go into a building, buy drugs in a hallway, or even leave the building, go somewhere else entirely before coming back to the police.
Right.
The controlled part helps, but it doesn't guarantee that the drugs came from that specific apartment.
I see. Okay, so let's get back to Kuntsevan. What convinced the First Circuit that this particular warrant was valid? What made the difference here?
Okay, so the court focused on a few key things. First, there was corroboration. Even though the police didn't see the actual drug deal inside, the informant had given specific details, right? Remember, they gave the exact apartment number, descriptions of the guys.
Yeah.
And some of that was backed up by the controlled by. The informant went into the building they named, went to the general area they described, and came out with drugs after supposedly buying them from someone matching the description.
So the fact that the tip's specifics lined up with what happened in the controlled buy, that was really important.
Exactly. It wasn't just any random drug buy. It happened after the informant pointed to a specific apartment, specific people. So the court thought that made it a lot less likely that the informant was making the whole thing up.
Got it. Now, what about the informant's past? Did the police know if this informant had been reliable before? Did they tell the judge about that?
That's a good question, and it's something that often comes up in these cases. In this particular case, the affidavit, the document they gave to the judge, it didn't really go into detail about the informant's track record, like if they'd given good info before, but the court said that the corroboration from the controlled buy was enough to make up for that. There's actually a pretty important quote from the First Circuit's opinion, they said. The risk that the informant is lying need not be wholly eliminated. So basically, they're saying that the controlled buy, because it backed up the tip so well, it gave the judge enough reason to believe the informant this time.
Interesting. So even if you don't have a long history of the informant being reliable, if there's strong corroboration in this particular case, that can be enough to establish probable cause.
Exactly, yeah. The court was basically saying, the circumstances of this controlled buy, plus all the details the informant gave beforehand, it gave the magistrate, the judge who signed the warrant, a reasonable basis to believe the informant. And that kind of leads into another important legal point, this idea of deference to the magistrate.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Basically, appellate courts, like the First Circuit in this case, they give a lot of weight to the initial probable cause decision made by the judge who issued the warrant. They're not going to overturn it easily. It's not about whether they would have signed the warrant. It's about whether the information given to the judge was so weak that no reasonable judge would have signed it.
So unless the affidavit was just completely lacking, the higher court is going to stick with what the first judge decided.
Pretty much, yeah. The idea is that the magistrate is in the best position to make that initial call, and the appellate courts don't want to second guess that unless it's really obvious that they messed up.
Makes sense. Okay, now I want to shift gears a little and talk about the search of Kuntsevan himself. I mean, the warrant was for the apartment for Fat Boy and Turtle. So how did the police searching Kuntsevan, which led to his arrest, how did that fit in legally?
Yeah, that's a really important point. And the court made a clear distinction here. Just because you have a warrant to search a place, that doesn't automatically give you the right to search every single person who happens to be there. To search a person, you need what's called individualized probable cause. There has to be a specific reason to think that that person is involved in a crime.
Right. So just being in the apartment, that wasn't enough to justify searching Kuntsevan.
No, not by itself. But the court said that a separate reason to search him came up after the police went into the apartment with the warrant. So they go in, and Kuntsevan, who matched the informant's description of one of the drug sellers, he tries to run away. And the court said that, combined with everything else, was enough to establish probable cause to search him.
Okay, so it wasn't just that he was there or that he fit the description, but it was him trying to run when the police showed up that made the difference.
Right. They actually quoted this part in the opinion. This flight, coupled with the controlled buy monitored by the detective and the informant's description, including height and weight, of two alleged drug traffickers selling drugs out of that apartment, was sufficient to establish probable cause to search the defendant's person without a warrant.
Okay, so the warrant got them legally into the apartment, and then Kuntsevan's actions, plus the fact that he matched the description, that's what gave them the okay to search him specifically.
Exactly, yeah. They had two separate things happening there.
So for people listening, you know, especially law students who are really digging into this area of law, what are the big takeaways from United States v. Kuntsevan? What should they keep in mind about this case?
Well, I think it really drives home a few key points. First, it reinforces that totality of the circumstances test. That's still the main way we figure out if there's probable cause, especially with informant tips. And it's not a checklist. It's about looking at the whole picture.
Right. You can't just focus on one thing. You got to consider everything together.
Exactly. Second, the case shows how important controlled buys can be, but also that they're not some automatic free pass. A well-done controlled buy can really back up an informant's tip, but it depends on the details of the tip and how well the buy matches up.
Right. The more specific the informant is, mm-hmm. and the more the controlled buy supports those specifics, the stronger the case for probable cause.
Yeah, exactly. And the third takeaway is the distinction between probable cause to search a place and probable cause to search a person. They're different things, and the Fourth Amendment protects both. Just because you can search a house doesn't mean you can search everyone inside.
Got it.
And lastly, the case really emphasizes that courts give a lot of weight to the magistrate's initial decision about probable cause. It's tough to overturn a warrant. You have to show that the judge was way off base.
Right, that there was really no good reason to sign the warrant in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
So big picture, United States v. Kuntz-Vaughn, it's a really helpful case for understanding how probable cause works in these situations where you have tips and controlled buys. It shows that a controlled buy can help a lot in justifying a warrant for a place, but you still need separate justification to search a specific person who happens to be there.
I think that's a great summary. And for anyone listening, especially those of you starting the Fourth Amendment, think about this. In the Kuntz-Vaughn case, aside from the controlled buy itself, what were the most important details that the informant gave? And how might the case have gone differently if the tip had been less specific, even if the controlled buy went the same way? Those are the kinds of questions that can really help you understand this area of law.
Absolutely. Great points to think about. And as always, we encourage you to keep learning about the Fourth Amendment and how search and seizure law is developing. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Thanks for having me.
See you next time.